Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, arms control discourses are centered around Western notions of modernity in civilization. What does it mean to decolonize the language around arms control? And first, inflation dominates the news in the United States, but what is the traditional media getting wrong about the story? And how permanent are these price increases? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. It's the economy, stupid. James Carville stated that in the 1992 election, and it's constantly repeated in every electoral cycle. But since the pandemic, the U.S. has faced challenges of a recovery of the economy that was largely shut down for medical reasons. This has resulted in issues such as supply chain disruptions and what's being reported as high rates of inflation. On today's show, we're going to explore inflation as an economic issue being reported in the United States and how it relates to the pandemic, to labor shortages, to economic recovery, and other issues. Our guest today is Dean Baker, senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Research Policy. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, and the co-author of Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People. Dean Baker, thank you for joining us. My first question, is this inflation that the U.S. is facing?
Well, first, thanks a lot for having me on. Your question, is it inflation? Absolutely. I mean, inflation means rising prices. And the latest data, if we take what's happened last year, October of 2020 to October 2021, our main measure of inflation, the consumer price index, has gone up 6.2%. So what that means specifically, this is a basket of goods and services. So we're averaging rent and car prices and bread prices and milk and gas and everything else in the world. And on average, that's gone up 6.2%. That's inflation. I can't argue that. The context that's often missing is that this has gone on everywhere. When I'm saying everywhere, I mean other wealthy countries. So we've had a huge political debate here where you have a lot of people, obviously, particularly the Republicans, who want to blame Joe Biden and the Democrats. And the reality is, well, you want to do that, but we've had comparable inflation in Spain, in the United Kingdom, in Germany. Is that all Joe Biden's fault? I mean, I think that gets kind of stretched the imagination. The more obvious explanation here is that we had the economy largely shut down, as were theirs, and we're reopening. And the idea that we could have this massive reopening without some serious disruptions to the economy would have been wonderful, but that's also pretty far-fetched. So yes, we're seeing inflation. No, it's not the disaster that it's often being portrayed as.
Are there specific sectors that are driving inflation? I've seen news reports suggesting that obviously gas prices rising seem to be, you know, one of the reasons for this. And I know things like the auto market, you know, used cars in particular seem to be driving a lot of these price increases.
There are particular sectors that are really big trouble areas. This is part of the reason why many of us don't see the inflation as an ongoing, enduring problem. So you mentioned oil. Well, if you remember when the economy shut down, oil prices literally went through the floor. They were negative. If you would agree to take delivery of oil, I think it was back in May or June of 2020, you would get paid. They would pay you to take delivery of oil. And that's because we had so much oil and so little demand that oil companies didn't know what to do with it. So if you would have agreed to take a barrel of oil, I forget what it was, they'd have given you 10 bucks or whatever it was. It was actually a negative price. So it was inevitable that oil prices would go back up. They're somewhat above the pre-pandemic level, but not hugely. I mean, oil prices did rise to $86 a barrel back last month. They're down to around 70 or so. I don't know the exact number today, but somewhere around 70 a barrel. That's somewhat above the pre-pandemic level, but not hugely so. But that's exactly the sort of thing that we expect to see with the recovery, that as the U.S., not just the U.S., but U.S., Europe, Japan, China, they all start increasing, people are driving more, we're getting closer to normal, that increases the demand for oil. So if we look, we compare prices today, gas prices in particular, to where they were a year ago, they're about 40% higher. That's because the economy is more or less back to normal. So oil's not real cheap anymore. Cars, you had mentioned, again, we know exactly the problem. There was a fire at a huge semiconductor factory in Japan earlier in the year, which has hugely reduced the world's supply of semiconductors, which are needed in cars. So most of the major manufacturers, I should say all the major manufacturers, had to cut back their production significantly, creating a real shortage of cars. New car prices are up about 10% over the last year. Used car prices about 27-28%. That's had a huge impact in our measures of inflation. That's added about 1.5 percentage point to the measure of inflation over this period. So you could point to some things like that that have had a real outsized impact. And those are going to end in the sense that oil prices, as I said, they've already fallen about 20% from their peaks. And car prices, the major manufacturers, Ford and Toyota, say they're already back at capacity. I presume the others will be fairly soon. So car prices are likely to come back down, and used car prices in particular. So that's the story why I and many others believe that this burst of inflation is a temporary story associated with the reopening of the economy, and it will come down. I mean, I don't expect it to be negative, but you know, we will see much, much lower inflation in the coming year.
On oil prices, what's the possibility that they'll actually kind of self-correct? Because what you're suggesting is that the reason why oil prices, and actually specifically the price of a gallon of gas at the pump, has gone up is because there's just more demand for it. And I guess we've learned a lesson from the pandemic that as demand drops, the price will drop. So consumers respond to the rising oil prices by choosing, for instance, more fuel efficiency vehicles, which of course, the possibility of tax credits or other economic incentives to deal with issues like, you know, carbon emissions and climate change. Is there a lesson to be learned here?
Yeah, well, there's both a short-term story and a long-term story. So I think the short-term story, because not everyone's going to trade in their car for a more fuel-efficient car or an electric vehicle, you know, that's not something that happens overnight. But what is more likely to happen in the near future, which is mixed benefit, we are seeing more oil production. So when you get higher oil prices, a lot of the producers that went offline, so here I'm thinking of a lot of fracking producers in, say, Texas and North Dakota, a lot of those went offline during the pandemic because the price was so low. They're going to start again, and they could increase their production pretty quickly. That's not a great story if we're concerned about global warming, but if you want to see the price come down, that will do that. And I think we are seeing that to some extent now. The other story, which is a longer term story and a hugely important one, it really obviously the future of the planet rests on, is that we move away from oil as a fuel. And this is about getting people into both more fuel efficient cars, insofar as they're still, you know, traditional internal combustion engines, but also more importantly into electric vehicles. And we're clearly going that way, not nearly fast enough, but the credits that are in the infrastructure bill, and we'll see what we get in the Build Back Better bill, assuming there is one, but that will encourage people to switch to electric cars, and that will reduce demand for oil, will reduce the price, but we'll care less. I mean, if we're all driving electric cars, we aren't going to care much about the price of gas. But again, that's not a this year, next year story. That's maybe a 10, 15 years out story.
Now, I know the conservative critique about what's driving inflation, my understanding is there's kind of two foundational arguments. One, that it's tied to government spending, so this increase in spending since the election inauguration of President Biden. And the other is worker wages going up as a result of labor shortages. Let's take the first one first. How valid is that critique that as government spending goes up, there's an expectation for inflation?
Well, the issue with government spending is that it boosts the economy, boosts demand in the economy. And there's no doubt that Biden's package, and give credit or blame, the packages passed in 2020 when Trump was still in the White House, those added to demand in the economy. And to my view, that's really kind of a great story, because here it is where the economy largely shut down last year in the spring. And now we're looking at 4.2% unemployment. That's a really low unemployment rate. I mean, when that number came out last Friday, I was like, wow, that's really good news. The Black unemployment rate's the lowest it had been since 2018 and before that ever. So, you know, getting the economy back to something pretty close to normal in the span of a year and a half or even a little less, that's a really, really good story. No doubt that spending helped to do that. And in doing so, yeah, it undoubtedly had some impact on inflation. But this is why I bring up the point about other countries. We see comparable rates of inflation, not necessarily as high, but pretty comparable in Germany, in Spain, in the United Kingdom. So I don't think we could blame that on Joe Biden's recovery package. So basically what I'd say is we were going to have serious problems. There was going to be some inflationary issues associated with the reopening of the economy regardless. I'm sure those were made somewhat worse by the fact that we did it so rapidly and we got people back to work. Again, in my view, a great thing, but a cost of that was somewhat higher inflation.
And then what about the question about labor shortage? I mean, we're in kind of an odd era at this point where it seems like there's a lot more jobs than there are workers, and definitely in certain sectors, that's more true than others. But the expectation has always been that as the labor market tightens, wages are going to go up. And then as wages go up, isn't there a natural expectation that prices will go up?
Yeah, there are two things on that. First off, I think we could very clearly say that the inflation we're seeing is not wage pushed. And the reason why I say that is we have data on what's happened with profits, and the profit share of income has actually risen sharply in 2021. So you're pretty hard pressed to say that wages are the factor driving inflation if profits, businesses are actually increasing their share of the pie. Clearly, that's not the immediate factor. Wages aren't the immediate factor pushing up prices. Doesn't mean that might not be the case at some point in the future. That has not been the case in 2021. The issue of the labor shortage here too, I think it's overwhelmingly a positive story. This is primarily at the bottom end. So these are workers who are working in restaurants, in hotels, low-paying occupations, and they're getting, many cases, first time in their life, really first time since the 60s, early 70s, that these workers actually have serious bargaining power. They have their choice of jobs. So they could say if they're getting paid too low or they're being treated poorly on the job, their boss is a jerk, they could say, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going across the street. Someone else wants to hire me. And I think that's a great thing. And what I'm hoping is that that will be to some extent enduring. In other words, if you have bosses that are jerks, they can't keep their workers. So either the bosses get fired or the business goes out of business. But that is, we are seeing high wage increases at the bottom end. Restaurant workers, the pay for workers in restaurants has risen 12.4% over the last year. So they're doing really well. Convenience stores, it's 20%. So we have the lowest paying jobs. You've seen the sharpest increase in wages. You go up higher on the wage ladder, that's much less true. And a lot of workers who are, say, earning 60, 70, 80,000 a year, they might be falling a little bit behind. I mean, not that that's a good story, but I'm less concerned about someone who's earning 80,000 a year falling 1 or 2% behind than, say, someone who was earning the minimum wage falling 1 or 2% behind. So to my view, that's overwhelmingly a positive story. And I expect it to be self-correcting in the sense that as you have businesses competing for workers, some will win, some will lose. The ones that lose go out of business. So where you have a lot of, particularly I'm looking at things like restaurants, small retail stores, you hear many of them say truthfully, oh, I can't afford to pay my workers, you know, another 10%, another 15%. Well, then they go, I mean, that's not a happy story, but that's the way capitalism works. If you can't pay the market wage, you're going to go out of business, and that will give us a more orderly labor market. Again, I hope it's always the case that, you know, workers even at the bottom have some choice, more so than they did during the pandemic. But I don't expect us to see the sort of jumping around, workers quitting their jobs as frequently and as many jobs going unfilled as you have today. I don't expect to see that story, say, 6 months or a year down the road.
Dean, the American consumers and certainly the political class really view inflation as this evil that needs to be avoided in a way that sometimes may not serve the interests of economic growth or the interest of wages. Are Americans a little bit too obsessed with inflation and sort of the history of that inflation, harkening back to the late 70s and the Carter administration seems to be, you know, the argument?
Well, there's a tough sort of chicken and egg thing. So yes, I think people are overly concerned about inflation. But I think a lot of this is driven by the media. And what I mean by this is I don't think most people are sitting down thinking, oh, my God, how big a problem is inflation? Would we be better off with less employment and lower inflation? Or is it really good? I'm not knocking people, but people have day jobs, you know, they have families. So they're not doing that. I think when they have fears about inflation, it's because they turned on the news for a few minutes. Maybe they read an article in the paper and they saw, oh, inflation, you know, people are concerned inflation's rising. I think it's largely a media driven story. And, you know, again, I've had people say, oh, well, the media is not telling them that the price of gas rose. And of course, that's right. But the point I always make on this is, if we think of what we do over the course of a day, you know, we buy gas, we, you know, go to a restaurant, we see our friends, this and that. We do all these different things over the course of the day. And maybe we notice the price of gas went up 5 cents. Not happy about it, but you don't think twice. But then if you hear on the news, oh, price of gas went up, well, that sticks in your head. So I think the media really plays an enormous role in hyping inflation. So I don't think it's that people have sat down and really thought about and said, oh, inflation's this really horrible problem. I think it's a problem that to a substantial extent has really been perpetuated by the way it's been reported.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the U.S. rate of inflation and economic recovery with Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Research Policy. I know you've written about the infamous CNN story about the rising milk prices. I mean, is the media certainly overhyping the story about inflation? Are they actually reporting higher rates of inflation than what's really going on?
Yes, they are. I mean, I saw that milk, CNN famous milk story, and it was close to absurd. First off, they talked to this family how much more they're paying in milk. None of us know how much this family's paying in milk. We don't know them. We don't know what their story was. What we do know is what happened to the price of milk over the last year. It went up 4%. Not trivial, but really not that big a deal. There's a lot of years you could point to the price of milk going up by more than 4%. Then they had this family consuming a huge amount of milk, 12 gallons of milk a week. Maybe they do. I have no idea. But, you know, that's an unusual family, if that's the case. So presumably you want a family that's more typical that you're presenting to the public. Then on top of that, they didn't talk about what was going on with their wages. They're presented as moderate income people. Well, they probably had big pay increases if they're moderate income people. So almost certainly their pay increases hugely outweigh what the additional money they have to pay for milk and other items. And then on top of that, they presumably have kids. If they're drinking 12 gallons of milk a week, they're getting the expanded child tax credit. So rather than suffering from a hardship, this family almost certainly is doing pretty well. Again, none of us know the specifics of this family, but a typical family in that position should be doing pretty well, where CNN presented as the exact opposite. I should mention the New York Times, and I pick on the New York Times because I think of them as the best. They did the exact same thing with gas. They had someone who just used an incredible amount of gas, if we take them at face value, and said they had to work 15 hours extra a week to cover the higher cost of gas. And, you know, if you back that out, they'd be buying something like 200 gallons of gas a week. And, you know, I have no idea how much gas this guy buys, but that's clearly not typical.
Absolutely. When considering the supply chain issues, and this came up in our conversation last week, we know that consumers have been buying a lot more goods, in part because the pandemic has shut down a number of the service industries. So we all have this money that we used to pay on for services that we can't go out and do. So we're buying goods. Is that tied at all, you know, to then the rising inflation? Or are those really two different issues?
No, that's a big chunk of that. And again, we could see the picture pretty clearly here. So we saw a huge increase in demand for goods beginning in the spring, continuing into the summer, both because people had more money, we had the pandemic checks, but it was also the case, as you said, people aren't going to restaurants, they're not taking vacations, they're not spending money on services that they would ordinarily be spending. So that led to this huge increase in demand for goods. At the same time, we also see that the supply chain, first off, you know, we had a lot of issues, our ports not being up to snuff, you know, we really neglected modernizing them as part of the infrastructure package. It is supposed to modernize them, but we hadn't done that. And also a real shortage of workers in key areas, particularly trucking. Again, that's results from trucking companies not paying enough. So people don't want to work in trucking. So that led to this huge supply chain issue, which has contributed a lot to higher prices. The positive side, again, what I'm optimistic about the future on inflation is that we are getting through them. Some of them, you know, we're hearing about measures that the Biden administration has been working with the ports to try to speed the rate at which items go through. But probably the more important factor is that it's going to be self-limiting. So people who bought a car, bought a new television set, bought a new refrigerator, all these kind of big ticket items, if you did that in the spring or summer, you're probably not going to be doing that again this winter. So we're going to see, and we are seeing, a fall off in demand for goods, a lot of these goods. And of course, also people are going back to restaurants, and we're spending more in restaurants now than we did before the pandemic. People are flying more. We're almost back to pre-pandemic rates of air travel. So we are seeing this shift back to a more normal economy, and that's going to lessen. I don't know if it's going to eliminate. I don't know how long it'll take us to get through all the backlog with supply chains, but it's definitely lessening the problem. And we're already seeing that, the benefits of that. I've been following television sets. We'll see what happens to the price of television sets tomorrow when the new consumer price index comes out. But television prices had risen rapidly at 9.8% from March to August, which is like a 25% annual rate. That's a really big deal. They've fallen since then, the last 2 months, 2.8%. We'll see what happens to the November data, but that suggests that the backlog that was created with all people buying television sets, we've gotten through that and prices are now falling. We'll see if they go back to where they were before the pandemic. My guess is they probably will. I mean, next month, but sometime in 2022. So I think we are getting through this big backlog. And when we do that, that's going to mean prices of a lot of goods, not just will they stop rising, but they're actually going to fall.
Another market that just seems to be remarkably inflated, we're really talking about bubbles here, is real estate. I guess first, is this tied to the same sorts of issues that we've been talking about? Is there something else going on? I'm worried when I see just, you know, how big this bubble is in real estate. Last time we saw a bubble like this, we ended up seeing it bursting pretty hard in 2008.
There's two different stories going on with real estate. One is that we see very low mortgage rates. So the mortgage rates fell at the start of the pandemic. They've been around 4.1, 4.2% if you go back to February of 2020. And they got it down as low as around 3%. And they're currently, I'd have to double check, but somewhere around 3.2 today. So it's a very low mortgage rate. So when you could get very low mortgage rates, it tends to put upward pressure on prices. So that's part of the story of the increase in house prices. The other part is a more interesting and you know, I think likely enduring one is that we've seen increased opportunities for working from home. Now, some of that is just pandemic and will go away, but I think much of that will be enduring. In other words, people are going to be able to work from home, if not completely, maybe 3 days a week, 4 days a week, show up at the office once a week or something, which means you don't have to live close to your work. And what we've seen with house prices is the biggest increase in house prices has been in smaller cities, in some cases towns. And in a lot of the high-priced areas, places like New York, Boston, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, prices have been fairly weak, in some cases actually falling. So that's a relocation story, as I say. I think that's overwhelmingly positive. Will that be enduring? My guess is it probably will. I don't mean prices won't fall. What I always say to people is if suppose the mortgage rates go back up to 4.1, 4.2, which is still low by historic standards. So I'm not predicting mortgage rates will go through the roof, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if we're talking a year or 2 years from now, the mortgage rates are somewhat higher than they are today, that probably will put somewhat downward pressure in prices. But this price increase, unlike the 2.7, the price increase in the first part of the zeros, this is driven by the fundamentals of the market. People are willing to spend more on a house, both, you know, the interest rate part of the story. But the other thing is if you're working from home, you need more space. And also you're spending less on commuting. So you don't have to spend so much money driving or taking a train or whatever it might be into your work. You don't need to, you have work-related expenses, like maybe you buy lunch at work. You have to have your clothes dry cleaned. I mean, there's all these expenses associated with going into an office that you don't have if you could work from home. So I do think that the rise in prices is likely enduring. And again, I'd say mostly a good thing because, you know, many of us had seen this story where a lot of people are priced out of the markets in places like New York and San Francisco. That's not going to end overnight. But insofar as we see somewhat downward pressure on the prices in those places And instead, smaller cities or places like Detroit that had been losing population, if instead those turn around and actually become places that, you know, have more vibrant economies, that's a great thing.
Interest rates, it seems as though that the institutions, like, you know, for instance, you know, the Federal Reserve is not responding to this inflation in a way that suggests that they think it's long term. I mean, is it fair to say that the financial institutions are indicating they think this is going to be a short term inflation rather than something long term?
Yeah, very much. And it's something, you know, I've often been skeptical of the wisdom of financial markets because I was warning about the stock bubble in the 90s and then the housing bubble in the zeros. So I realize financial markets very much can be wrong. But if you look at the interest rate on 10-year treasury bonds, last I looked, it was about 1.5%. There's no way on earth people are holding a 10-year treasury bond at 1.5% if they think we're going to see 5 or 6% inflation for the next 3, 4, 5 years. That makes zero sense. So they're betting that this inflation is very much temporary. That's, of course, the explicit view of the Federal Reserve Board. Jerome Powell, the chair, has said that repeatedly. So his expectation, at least what he says, is that we're going to see much lower inflation in the year ahead. And again, I agree with that. I think that's right. But it mirrors more what he thinks than what I think.
We know that opinion polls and, you know, perceptions, you know, things like, you know, consumer confidence are all suggesting that Americans are pretty concerned about inflation, concerned about the economic position of the country, and definitely concerned with the leadership coming from the White House. What you're indicating is maybe they shouldn't be so concerned, and this isn't as much of a threat as what's being reported. So what should the White House do, or what should, generally speaking, you know, what should economists do to try to break through and indicate that maybe you shouldn't be as worried as you are?
You know, we just have to, I think, keep reporting the data. And the Times, New York Times, had a very interesting piece a couple of days ago, it was Monday or Tuesday this week, where they had data from JP Morgan, which is obviously a huge bank, and they have credit cards. So they know people's bank accounts, they know how much is in their bank accounts. And what this piece reported was how much money people have in their bank accounts relative to what they had before the pandemic, when the pandemic started. And all groups, so they did this by income quintile, all income quintiles had considerably more in their account today than they did when the pandemic started. But the biggest increase were for those at the bottom. This is percentage increase, just to be clear. So a $1,000 increase in your bank account for someone in the bottom quintile that pours 20%, that's a large percentage increase, but it's obviously not all that much money. But, you know, but in any case, the point just being here that most people have much more money in their bank accounts than they did at the start of this. But yet there was another survey I saw not long ago. They asked people if they're not going to do Christmas shopping or holiday shopping, or at least less than they would ordinarily. And a substantial percent, let's say it was 20%, said they were going to either not do holiday shopping at all or substantially less. So you look at that and you go, okay, we know almost everyone, particularly those who are most stretched, they have more money in the bank today than they would ordinarily, but now they're saying they're going to do less shopping. So somehow they've got it in their head, or maybe they're just telling the survey taker that things are really bad for them when the data seem to indicate that they're not, that they're actually better off than they were, which again, I understand. Someone's in the bottom 20th percentile, they're not doing great, but they are doing better than they were pre-pandemic. In terms of, you know, what the administration could do, what I and other economists could do, I think just trying to talk realistically about the data. I mean, we were talking earlier about the job situation. I'd have to imagine that, you know, people working in restaurants, custodians, you know, people at these bottom end jobs that have the option to quit, that must feel great to them. And, you know, I think talking about that would be a great thing because, you know, here it is, you have people saying how horrible the economy is. You have all these people, a lot of them hate their jobs. They really hate their jobs. They're unpleasant jobs. They had a boss who was a jerk. And now they could just say, well, I'm going across the street and there's someone offering me more money and they seem like a better boss. That has to be great. You know, and I think it's really important to talk about that because that is something that, you know, the Biden administration could rightly take credit for that.
And of course, if you want to get a raise at your current job, the best way to do that is get a better offer someplace else. And then even if you like your current job, that you can, you know, ask them to offer to match it. And
yeah, exactly.
Frequently, that's actually the only way. Yeah.
No, exactly. You know, these workers at the bottom have bargaining power that, again, we haven't seen for many decades.
So the story is that inflation is real, but perhaps is not as permanent as what's being suggested. And even more importantly, I think the story is that we need to delve much more deeply into these numbers, much more deeply into these narratives to get a better picture than certainly what a number of the media sources have been presenting to us. So thank you very much. We've been discussing inflation and the economic recovery here in the United States. Our guest has been Dean Baker, senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Research Policy. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, and co-author of Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
When we come back, what does it mean to decolonize arms control? Discourse. Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Arms control discourses are centered around Western notions of modernity and civilization. With us is Ritu Mater to discuss this idea of colonization, of language. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. How much of the discourse on nuclear proliferation and other arms control is dominated by Western notions, and in particular, of civilization clash? What would a decolonization of the discourse on arms control mean for the future of nuclear nonproliferation? We discuss these issues in the concept of the West and the rest in civilization discourses with Ritu Mather. She is an associate professor of political science and geography at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And she's the author of the recently published book, Civilization Discourses and Weapons Control. Welcome, Ritu. First off, can you give a brief description of the argument that you're making in your book?
This book actually is providing a genealogy of the history of arms control and disarmament from the late 19th century to the present. So there are arguments put forward by scholars saying that the history of arms control and disarmament is quite short and that there are slender narratives of arms control. But my book actually is trying to show how this particular representation is incorrect, and therefore there is a need for us to have a larger, longer view of history to understand how this dynamics of West and the civilizational discourse with its racial underpinnings actually has shaped our current day, the architecture of arms control and disarmament.
Within the book, you make references to civilization clash and concepts of knowledge based on notions of civilization and on what you call the West and the rest discourses. In what ways does Western discourse or, you know, colonial discourse color the way that we view issues of arms control and issues of armament?
Actually, the book is not so much interested in looking at different definitions of what we understand as West or what we understand as civilizations. It is more regarding looking at these particular concepts of West as a civilization, as a rhetorical resource, which we draw upon to shape particular policies and practices. So there is a lot of contestation in terms of, yeah, what do we understand by civilization and what is this identity of a Western civilization? So within the book also, there is a little bit of a debate with regard to, like, you know, what is this identity of the West? Is it a racial identity? Is it a geographical identity in that sense? Is there some identity of a heroic West to some extent, or is it a question of a fragmented identity, but that the Western identity is used in a sense to mask the internal differences which might be existing in a sense, to provide a kind of a unified identity vis-a-vis the others in the international sphere. So there are these contestations, but the point of the question is, in a sense, when we talk about the West and the rest, how we place this dynamic, how it was introduced by Samuel Huntington at the end of the Cold War period for remapping the world order. And so this came across as something, suddenly a kind of tidal wave took place in the field of international relations. And all scholars were thinking about remapping the world order. Can we do it in terms of civilizational discourses? The book actually goes and talks about Huntington's representation, how we put it was West and the rest. But Arnold Toynbee at the end of the Second World War actually had spoken about the world and the rest. And his thoughtfulness behind putting that particular equation as the world and the rest was in a sense about whose voices do we want to represent? And I think that is a very important question for us as scholars in terms of whose voices are we representing, the voices of those who are suffering the most. And Toynbee argues that if you actually look at the history of civilizations for several centuries, you will find that it was the non-Western civilizations who actually suffered from the violence, the colonial violence which took place. And therefore, he says it is the world and the West. But Huntington turns the equation around and says the West and argues that there's a clash of civilizations in the making. And he says this clash of civilizations will take place because of nuclear proliferation. And that because of that, there will be a third, you know, world war possibility taking place. And he talks about the Islamic and Sionic nexus, etc. And so he makes these big, broad claims. But then there is a lot of question with regard to how is it that the field of arms control and disarmament did not question Samuel Huntington more rigorously when he made these particular claims. So that is what this book is trying to, in a sense, push Huntington's argument and say that there is a racial underpinning. There are practices of neo-racism at play. And Huntington's work is basically a classic example of neo-racism at play.
I think there's two things going on with Huntington's book and these concepts. I mean, first of all, sort of broadly, we think of Huntington as reminding us that even though the Cold War has ended, there's still a lot of conflict in the world. And the world's going to be marked by conflict. And that has had such a profound impact on the notion of, you know, the need for new technological advances in weaponry, the need to maintain a nuclear stockpile because there's always going to be threats. But then secondly is this notion that civilization, rather than, say, in international relations, we usually speak of states. You know, that's what's driving conflict. And of course, he was responding to Fukuyama's notion that it was ideology that was driving conflict. But then he reintroduces this notion of civilization. I know he's been criticized for a lack of definitional clarity as what he means by civilization. And in reading your book, I see that with you saying, well, I mean, civilization really is part of a colonial discourse. When I see that word civilization, I immediately think of the colonial discourses of things like the British insistence that their colonies needed to be civilized, for example. Is that what you're referencing as neo-racism? Or is there more to it than what I'm describing?
We'd often talk about technology. And so similarly, when we talk about, oh, now there's going to be a new clash of civilizations and weapons proliferation taking place, how are we going to address this? Now, this again is a limitation in the way we study the field of arms control and disarmament. So first of all, is this overemphasis on technology. And second, this overemphasis on the nation state, right, as a generic actor, as the key actor in international relations. Because that is how the discipline has shaped our thinking. I try to problematize these practices because I argue that because what you're doing is when you're creating this generic moniker of the nation state, you are depriving states and societies of their particular characteristics of their personalities. And you are in a sense saying, oh yeah, the West has a specific identity, but all these other actors, all these other states in the system, right, they are more or less the same. And as long as they imitate, they catch up in terms of technology, etc., they catch up with the rest. That is all that matters, right? And so this catch-up game, this imitation game, that all these other actors, they have the same attributes, right? So that all the other actors are the same actors. And you, as long as you understand these basic principles of who's the main actor and what are their specific attributes, you understand the field of arms control and disarmament. But this is precisely the limitation which we are talking about. Because if you look at the longer history of arms control and disarmament, it was only during the era of colonialism, with the rise of the Western culture, in a sense, or the Western civilization, that technology, which was often regarded as an attribute of a culture, every culture had its technology, but it was an attribute, it was embedded within a particular culture. It was not as if technology basically determined a particular culture. But what we are seeing now is in the field of arms control, instead of understanding technology as an artifact of a particular culture, as long as we restrain the technology, as long as we have control over the technology, we will be fine. And this is exactly where the problem actually starts happening, because then it is diverting our attention from what are the cultural, the racial, the scientific practices, the engineering practices which actually crafted this practices of arms control and disarmament. And therefore, I argue that instead of working with the existing concepts in the field of arms control with regard to a nation state or with regard to technology, it is important that we understand how the field of arms control and disarmament actually is being mapped in temporal terms, right? Understanding the logic of time and space and in arms control, and developing a conceptual framework which talks about practices of stereotyping, sly civility, and basically mimesis. So instead of working with the concepts which already are given to us and always talking in terms of, oh, this is a particular treaty or this is a particular nation state which has signed this treaty or not signed this treaty, because that limits our horizon, that limits our vision. What is really required to open up the vision is to understand really, in a sense, how did we even come to this particular the space of shifting from civilizations to talking about a generic modern nation state focused only on technology grasping, that's all. So shifting this architecture is very, very important.
What would be an example of a way to view this differently that could have, you know, kind of a practical implication for the way in which we speak about or conceptualize nuclear proliferation?
The question of technology, in a sense, is who has access to technology. So this question is in terms of the gatekeeping practices of arms control and disarmament. Who is deciding who will have access to technology, who will not have access to technology? And this is where a lot of the power struggle takes place. But the question of the matter is that it is not only because of after 1945, we got focused on nuclear weapons as a technology. But the fact of the matter is that these practices of governmentality, these practices of gatekeeping actually have been carried out since the 19th century. So, for example, if you look at it during the era of colonialism, when the shift took place in the weapons market from the mercantilistic market to a laissez-faire market, you know, so weapons became more easily accessible. But then what happened is that when there was when Europe was engaged in an arms race between different countries, and they had surplus of weapons and obsolete weapons, and so they wanted to sell it and to make profit, and so they sold those weapons to, you know, rulers in Asia, in Africa, etc. But once they started colonizing Asia and Africa, right, it became very important for them to make sure that the weapons do not fall into the hands of the common people, because then that will lead to revolts. And so, in a sense, to prevent revolts from taking place within the colonies, that actually, you know, you had arms control agreements like the Brussels Declaration, etc., being signed.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing what a decolonization of the discourse on arms control mean for the future of nuclear nonproliferation. Now, the challenge to the NPT at this point is the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that goes beyond allowing a nuclear club and a non-nuclear club to at least create an ideal of a zero option. Because the ideal is not having nuclear weapons, the enforcement of the nuclear weapons regime would shift from the nuclear states to let's get rid of all nuclear weapons, where the power would then shift to those countries, in particular those that have the technology but have chosen not to go nuclear, think of Germany and Japan, et cetera, but any non-nuclear state. Would that be an example then of at least an opening that could partially, the phrase you use is decolonize the language, decolonize the conception of the nuclear proliferation regime?
So the first question is, how do we decolonize the field of arms control and disarmament? There are already debates taking place within IR with regard to decolonizing IR, decolonizing security studies. But within the small field of arms control and disarmament, we don't hear any voices debating modernity, debating universalism in the sense the ideal, which you mentioned, of disarmament. Second thing is that when we want to decolonize, how are we going to undertake this decolonization? Because often we say, we cannot trust Iranians, we cannot trust North Koreans, they are corrupt, etc. Right? So we spatialize the problem. We say the problem is there, the problem is there, the problem is there. There's plenty of literature to say, okay, you know, which country is cheating and which country is hedging, blah, blah, blah. So what I try to do in this book is, instead of looking at it in terms of specific case studies and spatializing the problem, I talk about the temporal understanding of arms control, in a sense. There is a kind of a tunnel of time logic existing within the field of arms control. And therefore, we always talk in terms of practices of evolutionism. So for example, we say, arms control, has it made any progress from NPT? We are moving towards treaty of nuclear, you know, prohibiting nuclear weapons. So has there been some kind of progress, right? Have we achieved a kind of a better sense of justice within the society? Are we moving closer towards our ideal of disarmament? So there is this sense of how do we map the sense of progress? How do we map the sense of shift which is taking place? Now it is important to understand that this mapping is actually taking place in a linear time plane. So starting from 1945, then you come to 1967, the NPT Treaty 1970, and then you're coming to 2020. So this is some kind of a linear mapping which we are taking place, right? We're talking in the language of evolutionism. Now, again, this is very, very problematic because you see, during the era of colonialism, there was again the movement by the Orientalists, in a sense, to say that the Western society, the Western civilization is making an advancement. And the way you can map this advancement, this progress, is by linear mapping of societies. And that is how we have our sense of time, a linear understanding of time. And there was a way of saying other societies, their understanding of time is very cyclical, right? It is repetitive, right? It goes in a cyclical fashion. So nothing new is taking place in those particular societies, right? And so those societies are savage, they are barbaric. So it is very difficult to track any modernity or any kind of progress or development taking place in those societies. And it is because we have, in a sense, put these different societies, different civilizations on different timescales, we have a different way of mapping about who's making progress and who's not making progress. And so often it is because of these different timescales that we often refer to particular actors, like, for example, you mentioned Iran, North Korea, etc. We refer to them as the figures of alterity or the dirty dogs in arms control and disarmament. Whereas, on the other hand, those who are conforming to our principles, who are conforming to our timeline, in a sense, we refer to them as the noble savage, right? For example, Israel. So how we, in a sense, classify actors using these practices of Orientalism, using this temporal logic in which we put these different actors into play. Now, another thing when you're talking about moving on to this treaty of prohibiting nuclear weapons, in a sense, how did this treaty come into play? It came into play precisely because there was a sense of discontentment within the field of arms control and disarmament. Because many actors who were put into this category of being semi-civilized states, for example, China in the colonial era, etc., or semi-civilized or, you know, barbaric states, etc., and, you know, the global south in that sense, right? This understanding that, oh, they cannot govern themselves, they don't have any understanding of law, they don't have any understanding of rules, they have no conception of time, they have no conception of technology. So how can we, in a sense, give them these weapons? How can we provide them, you know, this thing? And so the custodians and the guarantors of the field of arms control are the Western powers, right? And that is how this distribution of power was justified for a long period of time. And it was precisely because of this revolt, and Hedley Bull recognized it, but he did not empathize with it. It was precisely because of this revolt, which has been there for a long period of time, that today you see a treaty on prohibition of nuclear weapons actually has been signed. Whether this is a signal towards modernity, towards achieving disarmament, that is a second question we can explore further.
So sort of at the core of a desire to have nuclear weapons is a notion of sort of political advancement. And you're talking about the way in which we've defined modernity, or we've defined even, you haven't used the word, but I'll use the word development, as a tied to the political prestige of having nuclear weapons, of becoming a part of the powerful club. That certainly was the major motivation of a country like, say, India and later Pakistan, wanting to develop nuclear weapons, and other countries doing so. So is the need to try to redefine what we consider to be modern as something other than the possession of nuclear weapons? Is that one of the goals in understanding this?
The thing is that, like, in a sense, when you talk about, you know, what pushed India and Pakistan to acquire nuclear weapons, right? And then there is always this generic logic, right? There's a modern nation state, and if you want to survive in the modern nation system, you have to basically acquire these weapons. And because these weapon systems, the weapons which you possess, they place you in a particular hierarchy in the international system. Every few decades, the technology or weapons technology keeps changing. But the question is that who has at the apex of this particular technology? So there is always this thing of catching up. Were India and Pakistan, in a sense, trying to acquire these weapons? Well, because they were trying to catch up with the West. Other way of looking at it was also because for a long period of time, these countries were also talking about nuclear disarmament. But basically, nobody was paying any heed to India's any debates with regard to nuclear disarmament. And so when they started talking about civilizational exceptionalism, when India started talking about in terms of, oh, we are like the US, right? We are both democracies. We both believe in laissez-faire. We both believe in free markets, etc. So there was, in a sense, the shifting of the discourse, right? Talking about American exceptionalism and talking about India's civilizational exceptionalism, that produced some kind of a bridging, in a sense, or partnering between these two different countries. So India, in a sense, what did it do? It tried to, in a sense, re-signify the civilizational metaphor, you know, and was opportunistic enough to use it in its own favor, right? So I think that is what, in a sense, would explain to some extent its behavior. But another thing was also the sense of frustration which came because of the indefinite extension of the NPT. Because what happened with the indefinite extension of the NPT was, you know, the colonial powers, the imperialist powers, there was a sense of their nostalgia of holding on to their power, holding on to their privileges. And the best way of achieving that was, you know, making this treaty an indefinite extension instead of every 5-year renewal. So when countries like India were faced with that particular option, you don't have any way out of it, then it becomes, okay, let's get onto this bandwagon of, you know, civilizational exceptionalism.
And of course, with this indefinite extension of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in the mid-1990s, the record has actually been, I think it's fair to say, it certainly has been worse. There's been a backsliding with respect to even the enforcement of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and this reconsideration of whether or not this is the model for which we should consider the management, the governance of nuclear weapons has certainly been called into question, ironically, not just by those who have been targeted, but also by the countries that are seemingly benefiting from it, with countries like, say, the United States, Russia, the unraveling of nuclear arms deals and this promise of development of new nuclear technology. So how much could the unraveling of the existing order open a space for the type of conversation that you're demanding and that the book very eloquently argues is this need for a reconceptualization of the way in which we talk about nuclear weapons?
There is a sense of, you know, that the field of arms control and disarmament is dying. It's a moribund discipline. So how do we, in a sense, revive this field? How do we reconstellate practices of arms control? And this is becoming increasingly difficult because the superpower is walking out of most of the arms control agreements, right? Whether it's the INF treaty, you know, and whether it's the TPNW, it tried to put a lot of obstructions in the negotiation phase, etc. The START treaty, the landmines treaty. So when you have such a disruptive, you know, a hegemon at play, which is so keen on talking about America first and its strategic interests. It is not talking about the rule of law. It is talking about strategic interests. It is talking about the American way of life or the Western way of life and saying that this is the only valuable way. This is the only valuable civilization worth preserving. It is under this particular discourse that it becomes a real challenge in terms of how do we reconstellate practices of arms control and disarmament. So three actually options come up. First of all, which came up from the humanitarian actors was disarmament as humanitarian action. So you had the ICBL campaign, you had the cluster munition campaign, and now you have the nuclear weapons prohibition campaigns, so the humanitarian initiatives. The second option which came up was Jack Donnelly talking about human rights as a new standard of civilization. So making a distinction between the old classic civilization, which in a sense he does not problematize about how it provided some kind of a tunnel of time for the other actors to walk through so that they could achieve a particular status of formal equality. And then now you have new standards of civilization which will result in domain expansion of the rule of law system. And so I basically provide a critique of this because when you talk about this human rights system as a new standard of civilization, first of all, the human rights discourse is very, very problematic because it is a discourse which came up when the West had lost its moral superiority at the end of the Second World War with the Holocaust. Second thing is that this discourse is very individualistic in nature, and with practices of surveillance, it can basically crush any kind of dissent, as was seen in the case of nuclear scientists in Western democracies like Oppenheimer, etc. So it is very difficult to actually organize any kind of collective effort of resistance in terms of talking about, you know, the legal practices. Another thing is that the human rights discourse is also being used to compete and undermine the existing discourse on international humanitarian law. And therefore, it is very, very difficult to talk about human rights as new standards of civilization. Also, because when you talk about the discourse, you talk about human agency, right, which is very, very important. But now what is happening is the technology is increasingly shifting towards automation, where the human element also is disappearing. So when we talk about the responsibility, when the weapons are being used, in a sense, who's responsible? Is it the weapon or is it the human agency? And that exactly comes into the case with regard to drone warfare, because somebody might be sitting over here, but then the action is taking place somewhere in Afghanistan or Pakistan. So there are different layers, different hierarchies of authority with here. And so how does this actually play out? So this discourse is extremely complex. Also, the human rights discourse, human rights law is the weakest law under the humanitarian auspices of the law legal system as such. So the US emphasizing human rights as a new system of civilization for regulating warfare, in a sense, is an extremely dangerous, slippery path to go through. The third practice is in terms of civilizational exceptionalism. And you find that with civilizational exceptionalism, particular countries like India or the US, they can stay at the helm of the hierarchy of the arms control, or they can achieve their own upward mobility. But that is not necessarily the case for the multiple actors, you know, more than 190 countries in the international system. So you see all these three different pathways are extremely weak. And so when we talk about, in a sense, remapping the constitutional nuclear order, I think we need to pay more attention to how law is basically being used as some kind of a civilizing therapy, as Angie mentions, basically. So civilizing therapy, in a sense, to pacify, to maintain some kind of a status quo within the particular system.
So your book fundamentally is a clarion call for a wider, more diverse set of voices and a wider and a more diverse set of concepts being brought into our discourses on weapons control and nuclear weapons and weapons control across the board. And in that spirit, your book absolutely contributes to those wider and more diverse voices. The book is called Civilization Discourses in Weapons Control. The author is Ritu Mather, our guest. She is the Associate Professor of Political Science and Geography at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. Really appreciate this.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.